Welcome to the France 24 debate. Israel, as we speak, is bringing the war back to the people of the Gaza Strip. A ground operation is underway to take back control of the Netzarim corridor. This followed the extensive bombardment on Tuesday, with over 400 Palestinians killed. Out of those 400 plus, Israel says there were five senior Hamas leaders whose lives were taken. Where does this leave the quest for peace in the Middle East? In Jerusalem this Wednesday, demonstrations calling for peace and the safe return of the remaining 59 Israeli hostages held by Hamas since October the 7th, 2023. Remember, back then, some 250 hostages were taken by Hamas and at least 1,200 Israelis were killed in that cross-border attack staged by the Hamas group. So with the peace deal, phase one expired and not renewed, with accusations of breaking the accord on both sides. And now with Israel's all-out assault taking the region back into a war scenario, there are so many questions on where this leads. Our panel to discuss the situation. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Khaled El-Gindi, visiting scholar at Georgetown University's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Khaled, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us from London, Nomi Bar-Yaakov, international peace negotiator at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Nomi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Mark, for having me on the show today.
Here in the studio, Mark Lefebvre, who's a member of the Meretz Party and founder of Peace Now. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Good evening.
On the opposite side of the studio, John Linden, executive director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace. John, great to see you. Thank
Good
you
for joining us.
And joining us from the Gaza Strip is Olga Cherevko, spokesperson of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Olga, thank you for being with us too.
Thank you, Mark.
We will bring in the panel to discuss the situation after this report by Eliza Herbert here at France 24.
This is only the beginning of Israel's renewed offensive, according to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But for Palestinians in Gaza, it's the return to a nightmare. Digging through rubble to recover bodies, ferrying the dead and wounded to already depleted hospitals, prayers and mourning.
I lost my whole family. I got married recently in 2023. God honored me with Mohammed, who was so beautiful, and my wife was pregnant. She was martyred while she was pregnant. My son was martyred too.
For the second night in a row, Israel struck several targets across the Gaza Strip, including this makeshift camp in Khan Yunis.
I want to tell Benjamin Netanyahu that it is not manly to attack civilians in their tents. Manly is to find the soldiers in the fields.
Israel Defense Forces say they are targeting Hamas command centers and in the last 24 hours have issued evacuation orders affecting nearly 100,000 Palestinians, raising concerns of another ground operation. While in Israel, resentment towards the government is pouring into the streets. Thousands marched towards the Knesset on Wednesday, accusing Netanyahu of resuming the war for political gains. It is the second day of protests, with many worrying he is further endangering the 24 hostages still believed alive. And outraged by his attempts to fire the head of Israel's internal security service, the Shin Bet.
We want to be a democracy, and we are on the way to dictatorship.
And the hostages are still in the tunnels, and we want them home now.
Public opinion polls in Israel show support for a second stage of the ceasefire, but Netanyahu has all but ruled out a return to peace, saying on Tuesday that future negotiations with Hamas will take place only under fire.
Eliza Herbert with that report. Since Eliza made that report, of course, the ground operation has begun. The Netzarim corridor has been retaken by Israel's troops, and the situation in Gaza has also seen a shelling of some description on a UN base. Let's go to the Gaza Strip and speak to Olga Cherevko, a spokesperson of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Olga, the situation where you are, give us a sense of the humanitarian situation, but can I just get you to comment on the words of Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, who's severely condemned the Israeli shelling of a UN base in Gaza?
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark. We have had a couple of very intense days. And of course, as you've seen from the news and the earlier statements by the Secretary General, as well as the Director of the UN Office for Project Services, we lost one of our colleagues and several more were injured when their guest house was hit earlier this morning. Of course, this comes after several days of intense shelling and bombardment that has continued through the night last night and today, and is, of course, part of the horrifying reports that we're seeing of hundreds of people being killed and injured in the past couple of days.
In terms of what you're seeing right now, the humanitarian situation before this began was already very difficult, described as catastrophic by some. How would you describe the situation now?
Precisely. It's, I think we're, to be honest with you, we're running out of adjectives to describe the situation because it was, we had some reprieve during the ceasefire in which we were able to scale up assistance and deliver life-saving support to hundreds of thousands of people who have just begun to recover from 15 months of relentless violence. And now they're subject to it over and over again. And there just doesn't seem to be an end to this. And we are absolutely shocked by what is happening.
Olga Fanau, thank you very much indeed. Let's bring you from Washington, Khaled El-Yindi, a visiting scholar at Georgetown's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Khaled, your reaction to the news that the, as we speak, the ground invasion, limited, as the Israeli army says, but nonetheless still happening. It's underway.
Yeah, I think sadly there isn't a lot that's surprising. What we've seen over the last few days and the previous 16 or so months is an Israeli assault in which there are really no red lines of any kind, whether moral or legal. And this is the result when Israeli leaders can say that we're targeting five individuals and are willing to kill more than 430 innocent civilians in order to achieve that, and the world looks on helplessly. I mean, this is completely dismantling the rules of war and the international-based order. I think both of those have just been completely shattered. And so without any constraints, we're really just, you know, Palestinians are at the mercy of the Israeli army and political leadership, because at the end of the day, this is really about Netanyahu saving his political life more than it is anything else.
Khaled, I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Let's bring in from London, Nomi Bar-Yaakov, international peace negotiator, Geneva Center for Security Policy. Nomi, peace is in your job description. But peace, I imagine even you find it very difficult to see where peace can come from right now.
Well, I think the only place it can come from is from US President Donald Trump. And I think he's been sending mixed signals and a very inconsistent policy. First, there was this hideous plan to evacuate, forcibly evacuate, in other words, ethnically cleanse the entire strip from 2.4 million Palestinians. Then came the threats that if Hamas doesn't release all the hostages, there are 59 of them, 24 to be alive, all hell will break loose. And the problem is that Netanyahu's government, a very, very extreme government, most extreme by a very long shot in Israel's history, is only interested in its own survival. And they don't care about the hostages. So, and they take Trump quite literally. We know that he tends to backtrack. And I would suggest that peace can come from an urgent meeting between US President Donald Trump and the Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Tamim Al Thani. I think that is urgent. And I think he has tremendous respect, Trump, for kings and for royals and for wealthy people. And they have a personal relationship. And I think that needs to be, as to use Donald Trump's language, on the cards. I think that's where the cards are. And of course, also the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, again, also very, very important, because don't forget that Donald Trump met with Netanyahu, and it was after Netanyahu, the first foreign leader he met with, that he came out with this outrageous plan that, you know, we quite frankly thought was completely insane. The Arabs came back with a very, the entire Arab League led by Egypt came up with an excellent plan, not perfect, but excellent. And, you know, it's a framework plan, 106 pages, which I read very carefully, meticulously, offering a counter plan. And in order for Europe and eventually, I assume, also the US to support the plan and to ensure that not one Palestinian will be displaced from Gaza, that's the way to peace. That's what we need to do. We need to unite. We need a united Europe, not only for Ukraine, but also for Gaza and the Middle East. We need to know that the end goal is two states within the 67 lines, two sovereign states living side by side. The Arab plan makes that very clear. And we need to get the Qatari leader and the Saudi leader directly involved.
Thank you very much indeed. Let's bring it into the studio now and then, Dan. Let loose now, Mark Lefebvre, member of the Meretz Party, founder of Peace Now. Peace Now. That'd be a nice thought, wouldn't it?
Well, there is no end to the need for peace. I mean, we are in a situation, you have two people living on the same in the same area, and none of them will disappear. So we can continue the situation where this very sad and painful situation where the two people are at the mercy of their own extremists. I mean, if there has been, just to correct what has been said, slightly correct what has been said before, if there has been a deadly Israeli assault, there wouldn't have been any assault of Israel if the Hamas did not plan the massacre of the October 7th.
I think nobody is disputing that.
We have to correct a little bit the things, but having said that, the two people are at the mercy of their own extremists who have no solution for the future, not on one side and not on the other side. So from the Israeli standpoint, the question now, since the democracy of the state of Israel is at stake, actually, is the amount and the nature of the mobilization which will take place in order to restrict, to ban what is being done now, which is a real influence of the Trump organization. I mean, Netanyahu has lost his temper. Yes, I mean, if you look at him on a day-to-day basis, he has lost his temper. He doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, he has no strategy on the long term. He has a strategy for the next coming days, but he has no strategy on the long term. So he's driving the state of Israel into a deadlock. On the other side, Hamas also is driving the Palestinian people into a deadlock, because Hamas had somehow also an interest in having the war starting again, because there are obviously some plans which could be prepared and could be put in place where the Hamas influence can be removed. I mean, if the joint Saudi Arabia and Egyptian plan is put in place, Hamas has no longer control of the Palestinian situation. So Hamas has today interest in renewing the war, and so we are in this hilarious and sad situation where both people are in the hands of their own extremists with no solution, unless there is a mobilization on the Israeli side which has to last more than a big demonstration today.
Mobilization of people.
It has to continue and take other forms and other natures. But also the ball is also in the court of the Palestinian society. There are Palestinians who are realistic and we are driving towards a compromise and a two-state solution. We have to hear them. And so from the Israeli peace camp, we need to hear more loudly also the voices of the Palestinian camp.
Understood. Can I bring you in, John, on that point? Because it must be difficult to be in the rubble of the Gaza Strip and be considering issues like that, because you must feel that there's no political process that is there for you. There is no diplomatic process that's there for you. And you can barely get the humanitarian aid that you need. It must be very difficult to take the view that Mark's taking if you're in the rubble in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, I mean, for the civilian population of the Gaza Strip, it's a life or death situation right now. And politics, diplomacy, all of these ideas are abstract if you're in fear of being bombed in your tent when you go to sleep tonight. And with, you know, again, if we think about the context right now, we're being told that this war needs to recommence to get the hostages out of Gaza. That assumes that more military force, and Gazans will tell you this, that they have suffered so much military force over the last year and a half. How much is enough? How much is the trigger point when you have almost 2 million people have been displaced, you know, over 50,000 people killed, over half of the housing stock destroyed or damaged? It's hard to believe that the Israeli electorate would believe that this is the route to freeing the hostages. And for Palestinians, we actually do see quite a visceral reaction to Hamas within Gaza. We've had three successive polls over the last sort of 4 months or so that show record low levels of support for Hamas. Right, so there is an off-ramp here diplomatically with regards to the Arab-Saudi or the Egyptian-Saudi plan that was mentioned, which would allow governance absent Hamas. But in order for that to happen, Israel needs to engage with it. You have Hamas at the lowest point with regards to its popularity in Gaza within living memory. Rolling the dice again on this war could change that. And also, we have heard from evidence given to the Israeli Defense Committee this week that Hamas and Islamic Jihad apparently have 30,000 troops, mostly young men who are traumatized now, which is almost close to the level of the troop assessment they had on October 7th in 2023. Yeah. So one is left wondering, what has this war been for? The hostages are still in their dungeons. Gazans' lives have been destroyed. And now Israel is about to embark essentially on a new war with the lowest level of popular support that I'm aware of in any war in Israel's history. We know from the polling of one of our members, the Accord Institute, that 7 in 10 Israelis want to see an end to this war and the release of the hostages. And by a 3-to-1 margin, Israelis favour the completion of the second phase of this ceasefire, which should see the IDF withdraw from the Gaza Strip over the continuation of the war. So I ask again, who is this war for? And there's an analysis about maybe it serves the political agenda of actors in Jerusalem more than either hostages in Gaza and certainly the Palestinian people and Israeli security.
John, thank you. Let's go back to the Gaza Strip. Olga Cherevetko is there, spokesperson of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Olga, I don't know whether you are able to comment on anything politically that any of our guests have said. If you can, please feel free to do so. But I'd like to start you off by talking about humanitarian matters, which is clearly where you work. And I'm imagining what things are like right now for people in the Gaza Strip who are trying to settle down for the night, perhaps what they're facing. Where will they eat? Where will they sleep? What is it like?
Yes, Mark, you're exactly right. For the last few weeks, I've been going around across Gaza Strip and speaking to different people. And many of them, of course, have moved back to the areas where their homes once stood. And they're living literally on top of the rubble of their homes with whatever things that they have, maybe a tattered tent, maybe some blankets, maybe nothing. And all of them have said to me, the one thing that we don't want is a resumption of this war and that we finally got some hope through the ceasefire. But then, of course, even during the ceasefire, 2.5 weeks ago, as you know, the crossings for the entry of all cargo were closed. And so for more than 2 weeks now, we have not received anything that has entered, nothing has entered the Gaza Strip. So this means we've had to ration our supplies and reprioritize the way we deliver assistance to try to make it last as long as possible to reach as many people as possible. But the conditions here on the ground are abhorrent, I can tell you this.
So when families are trying to bed down this evening, they're in tents, if they're lucky, under a tent, if they're lucky, of course, regardless of what the temperature will be.
Correct. And it's getting, it's been very hot, and now it's actually extremely windy, and it's supposed to rain, so you're really at the mercy of nature, and there's nothing to protect you. Even before this began, we had about 1 million people living in extremely substandard tents. Despite the efforts that we've made already to distribute shelter assistance to the people as much as we could.
Olga, bear with us. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Olga there from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Let's go to Washington. Khaled El-Yindi is there from Georgetown Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Khaled, thanks for being with us. I'm trying to get around everybody as quickly as I can, but obviously you all have things to say and we need to hear what you say. I'm left thinking after what Olga has said, that the forced closure and eviction of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency from East Jerusalem clearly hasn't helped affairs. At the time I was there in Jerusalem, they were saying they needed to send in something like 130,000 tents to help people. And of course, that wasn't going to happen. Getting things in to help people is a massive issue, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And even though there was an upsurge in humanitarian aid after the ceasefire went into effect in late January, it was limited. It was mostly food and medicine, which, of course, is badly needed. But things like temporary housing, Israel still barred from entering Gaza. When you combine that with the steps that have been taken since then, the complete closure since March 1st of any humanitarian assistance entering Gaza, in addition to the massive bombing and destruction, then an alternative. So I don't agree that there's an assumption that both sides aren't going anywhere. There is an alternative vision that has been put on the table by President Trump. And that is for the expulsion, forcible expulsion of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. And the way to do that is through massive bombing, collective punishment, denial of the basic necessities of life like food and medicine and proper housing. And then people will leave. And I think there are those in the Netanyahu government, as we heard, it's the most extreme government in Israel's history, who would like to see Gaza depopulated, who openly talk about that as the goal, and who have said that if Netanyahu continues with the ceasefire, specifically phase two, they will bring down his government. And so these are the people who are dictating the terms that Netanyahu is following. And so this is very much about Netanyahu's political survival and the lowest common denominator of the extremists in Israel who are deciding the fate of Palestinians on the ground. And so the fact that the president of the United States has endorsed this idea that you can forcibly remove an entire population, i.e. ethnic cleansing, is very attractive, I think, to Netanyahu. Why would he stick with a ceasefire plan that will bring down his government when the president has endorsed something that is actually seen as achievable now? And this resumption of the war, I'm afraid to say, I think we have to consider the possibility that the end game isn't at all two states or whatever the Arab states and the European Union might be talking about, but something else entirely, and that is the expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza, and that could open up that same possibility in the West Bank.
Khaled, thank you very much indeed. The military operation is ongoing in the West Bank by the Israeli Defense Force. That is something that I certainly saw firsthand when I was on assignment there at the end of January, beginning of February. The situation in the West Bank really getting worse as that goes. The latest on the ground invasion is that the area, the Netzarim corridor in the center, more or less retaken, it says here, Israeli troops advancing towards that, taking that area that divides the north from the south. That is the latest coming in from the ground. Let's bring in Naomi Bar-Yaakov, who is in London from the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Naomi, it's a fact that this administration of Netanyahu is the most extreme that there's ever been. That is a fact. It's not an opinion.
Yes.
He is in some way a slave to what they want, or is he actually doing what he needs for his own political survival? What would you say?
I say that there's no contradiction between the two. He's doing what he's doing for his own survival, which means that he is bowing to everything that they're requesting. So, for example, he just got the most extreme party, Otzma Yehudit, led by Itamar Ben-Gvir, back into the government. His condition when he left, he said he will return into the government. He's quit the government with his party when the second ceasefire came into force just before President Trump took office They came into force on the 19th of January of this year. So he quit the government, and here we see him, and now he's rejoined the government, and they were negotiating the conditions of, you know, he's always, you know, trying to get as many concessions out of Netanyahu, usually very, very successfully, but his condition for returning was a war. And the war isn't just a symbolic war, as Khaled al-Gindi of Georgetown just said, you know, they are planning to expel all the Palestinians. They've already announced which airport will carry Palestinians. This is the Ramon airport in the Negev, adjacent to Gaza, and the Ashdod port. It's a town just north of Gaza on the Mediterranean. They will open the port to expel Palestinians. They are making practical, they as the government, practical plans for expulsion. So I reiterate my suggestion from earlier, it's absolutely vital that the negotiations move to the top level. It's not always necessary, but it's absolutely necessary that President Trump meet directly with the leader, with the Emir of Qatar and Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. They must set the limit to what is happening very, very quickly, because I agree with Khaled that the intention of the government is to retake the Gaza Strip. They've issued orders for evacuation all over the Strip, north and south, and they've said that they're going to collate all of the Palestinians. I mean, I don't know how they're going to do it, 2.4 million in one area alone. And they have also stated that those who will refuse to go will be treated as hostile. In other words, they will be treated like they treat Hamas combatants, even if they are 100-year-old civilians. So they are forcibly, these evacuation orders are not voluntary. It's not, oh, if you want, you leave, and if not, then you're risking your life, which is what we've seen for the past, since the beginning of the war, for the past year and a half. Now it's like, you know, if you don't leave, you will be treated as a Hamas combatant. So I think, you know, this is a very, very, this is a serious escalation, this renewal of the war. The rhetoric has escalated. And the more the rhetoric escalates on the part of the government and the statements, and also don't forget there's a new chief of staff, and this chief of staff is coming in as a hardliner, more hardline than the outgoing chief of staff, Herzi Levy. And the first thing that he did when he came into office was he was quote unquote implementing the Trump plan, making practical steps as to how they're going to evacuate, quote unquote, ethnically cleanse, in other words, the Strip. So it's very, very serious. And that's, again, it's really important that negotiations move to a higher level, because Netanyahu is not going to allow anything to happen. And the only way this will stop is if Trump makes it stop. Israel is dependent existentially on the US. Israel cannot survive without US support. It certainly can't carry out a war without US support. And this call is absolutely urgent.
Naomi, thank you. And thank you for that reiteration of what you said earlier, because I'll put it to the gentleman in the studio about Donald Trump, because some might say that Trump's modus operandi is transactional. There's got to be something in it for him business-wise. I mean, clearly the idea of changing the Gaza Strip into Dubai on the Mediterranean was all about how much money he could make, surely. Mark?
No, I don't think this is serious. I mean, even Trump dropped down this gigantic this idea of evacuating the Gaza Strip. He dropped it down when he saw the reactions of the Arab countries. So this issue has to be addressed seriously now. The point is that what is the capability and the capacity of Trump of actually running serious negotiation on any front. When you see his lack of experience and the way he's putting himself in a weak position in front of Putin, you can have reasonable doubts about his capacity of running serious negotiation and successful negotiations for the Middle East. So I think the ball is in the hand of Saudi Arabia and Egypt. If they are strong enough to put pressure on Trump, we will see things moving forward. At the same time, all the plans which were mentioned about of the extreme right parties in Israel to plan to evacuate the Gaza Strip, the military establishment And the security establishment is strongly against it and sees that as totally unrealistic. Even if there are more right-wing or more left-wing generals, they see that as totally unrealistic, and cannot be achieved. So the key point here is to what extent the Arab countries, which want also to be to solve the Palestinian issue, because the fact that the Palestinian issue is not solved is also a threat for the stability of their own regime. Okay, so they have to put forward not only proposals but also money on the table to make it to make things moving on and make sure that Hamas influence is diminished to the minimum in order for the Palestinian people to try to breathe again.
John, can I bring you in on the same issue? Nomi's suggestion, I think, is that bigger players get involved and make this happen. And I think there is a real sense that that is something that needs to... We need to take this beyond Netanyahu's remit and actually get some bigger players to sort of actually knock that sort of square peg into the round hole, as it were.
Yes, although unfortunately I can't put all my faith in those big actors because they've let the Israeli and Palestinian people and the cause of peace down for decades on end. So I think it's insufficient as a strategy. It's hope. Yes, it needs to happen. There's talk of an event in New York at the UN in June that the President of France and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia may be working on that could help to catalyze something in that direction. But it needs something on the ground in addition to it. So President Trump is transactional. Yes, he's been saying some very extreme things about what needs to happen. And I think breaking taboos that really shouldn't be broken around the displacement of people. But he also likes being popular. And he's incredibly popular in Israel. In fact, he's more popular in Israel than he is, I think, in almost any state in the Union, in the United States. And this idea of the resumption of war and the mass displacement of Palestinians or the annexation of the West Bank, those are not popular ideas. Unfortunately, they're growing in popularity, but they're still minority issues inside Israel. So if we can see tens of thousands of Israelis taking to the streets, hundreds of thousands of Israelis calling on President Trump to do exactly what Nomi has been saying, then that will be a signal directly into the White House that popularity and the Nobel Peace Prize cliche that we've been hearing and Donald Trump being a figure of celebration in Israel and for the Jewish people, and all things that inflate that man's ego, that can be used, I think, as part of the transaction of the system that we need. But more than that, I think that, you know, Mark mentioned about the need for a Palestinian peace camp, but we have one. There are people on the streets in Palestine constantly working on ideas to disrupt this situation. They need the chance to self-actualize. We need to see Palestinian leadership that reflects the will of this young, impatient, scared population who are living through the most existential moment since 1948. And for Israelis, before October 7th, people understood that their democracy was under threat. This government was incredibly extreme. Then the worst war in the country's history has come along. People are shocked and exhausted and terrified. And I think if you take the aggregate emotions of Israelis and Palestinians right now, it is not a call for war. It is an exhaustion of what's been happening over the last year and a half and a desire, a yearning for something else. Now, it's on the international community to provide the diplomatic horizon, to point us toward it, to convince Israelis and Palestinians their security, sovereignty, freedom can be delivered by diplomacy and nonviolence. And it's also on the citizens themselves to organize, to take to the streets and to force their political leaders down that track. There will be an event in Jerusalem in May, May 8th and 9th, called It's Time, which will see thousands of Israelis coming together and Palestinian citizens of Israel and Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza over Zoom because they can't come into Jerusalem, asking the international community to provide that diplomatic horizon, showing there's a constituency from it. But it's one hand clapping. We need to have the international community play their part, the people on the ground play theirs, and stop waiting to see what this extreme Israeli government are going to do or what Donald Trump is going to say, and instead make momentum from the ground, from the streets, and from the diplomatic community that are opposed to these sort of measures.
So that's... Go ahead, yes. Mark. Go ahead.
Yes. What is interesting is to see what will happen in the next coming days once the ground operation has started again. Nobody knows exactly what will happen. The Israeli government has announced that he's putting force, he's forcing the Hamas to release hostages. I think Hamas will wait for the next fault and the next humanitarian failure of the Israeli army to have this ground operation stopped immediately. So, I mean, in a few days, we will see that there is no strategy behind this operation, this military operation. I don't think this military operation will last forever. First of all, there are no military reserves because the army is exhausted. And there are less and less people who are able and willing to serve for another war. So I think this strategy of this new military operation to force Hamas to relinquish is a total failure. And at the same time, there are more and more leaks in the press, okay, of the involvement of Netanyahu with Qatar. I mean, his image will be weakened, significantly weakened. He's the only one, Benjamin Netanyahu, is the only one who is still in charge after October 7th. All the other responsible have acknowledged their responsibility and somehow resigned or have been forced to resign. The only one who stays is Netanyahu. Do you think that you will stay as it is now for a year and a half until the next election? I don't think it's feasible.
Mark, thank you. Let's go back to the Gaza Strip, where Olga Sherevko is waiting for us, the spokesperson for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Olga, Mark here is saying that Netanyahu has no strategy. You have a strategy. You're coping with chaos. You're coping with the most difficult situation there. Give us a sense of what this ground invasion means for you. Mark's saying the ground invasion won't last a long time, but nonetheless, it has a major impact on the people you're trying to help.
That's correct. What we've always said is that we absolutely cannot go back to the scenario that we had before this ceasefire. And now that the hostilities have resumed, we cannot return to the restrictions that we had, where we spent hours waiting for green lights, hours waiting for clearances to move, instead of spending these hours in helping people. And this is something that is unacceptable for us. If these hostilities continue, there are two non-negotiable principles for us, and that is protection of civilians. Civilians must be protected at all times, and also facilitation of our work.
We're seeing and hearing, and it's been in our reports, Olga, of tragedies. And it's one of these things, you become so almost, it's hard to say, almost immune to it, because you see it so often about families being wiped out, you know, a man there holding his dead child. It's the kind of thing that it's in people's nightmares. You're seeing it on a day-to-day basis. How are you coping with having to help people who, you know, have no access to healthcare, no access to water, no access to the food they need?
Yeah, we have to do what we can. Of course, we've been here since the beginning, and we just try to do it every day, to deliver what we can, to reach as many people as we can, and to really improve their lives, at least on some level. And this is what's so unfortunate, is that we actually started to manage to make some progress during the weeks of the ceasefire. And now we're risking to lose it all and go backwards many, many steps.
Olga, thank you very much for joining us from the Gaza Strip. Olga Sherevko, who is from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, with that, well, moving testimony of what her job is on a day-to-day basis, coping among the chaos of the Gaza Strip. Back to Washington, Khaled El-Yindi, the visiting scholar at Georgetown Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Khaled, give us your sense, as we're starting to wrap up this debate, and we haven't found a solution yet, of course, and we're not the only ones who've yet to find a solution, but the ground invasion, the second stage now underway, when we were expecting and hoping for a phase two of a peace deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've sort of hit upon what's the only thing, there are two things that can change the current dynamic, that can change Netanyahu's calculus. One is the Israeli public, and to the extent that there is any political, formal political opposition, to effectively bring down the Netanyahu government. And the other is pressure, as we heard, from the United States. Those are the only two forces that can act and to alter Netanyahu's cost-benefit calculations, because up until this point, he has not paid any price, politically or otherwise, and has had no incentive to end the war, and has many incentives to prolong and continue, because at the end of the day, most of the costs, if not all of the costs, are borne by Palestinians themselves. And so this, I think, in the absence of those two, I think it's very unlikely that Donald Trump is going to put any real pressure on Netanyahu, especially when a Democratic president, Joe Biden, refused to put any pressure himself. And Trump has said openly that, you know, he's fine with whatever Israel wants to do. They want to maintain the ceasefire or if they want to cancel it. I think just to echo a point that's already been made, the international community writ large has failed, as we heard from the representative from OCHA and other UN humanitarian workers on the ground. The international community has failed to uphold the laws of war, of the rules-based order, to intervene, to impose a cost. Yes, the United States holds many of the cards, but European nations also don't have to continue to finance Israel's war. They don't have to give Netanyahu, who after all is an indicted war criminal, a pass. They can enforce international law within their own boundaries. They can hold Israeli soldiers who travel to their countries accountable for the crimes that they themselves are recording and distributing on social media. There is a lot that the international community can do short of the pie in the sky, two-state solution, peaceful end to the conflict. There's a lot that can be done in the short term just to hold Israel accountable for the atrocities that we are seeing on a daily basis. But that takes some political will and is not entirely dependent on Washington.
Khaled, as you were talking to us, we're showing images coming in from Jerusalem of the kind of thing that I think is what you're talking about, saying the likes of Trump probably won't act to change things because he says Israel could do, as far as he's concerned, whatever they wish. We're seeing here that Israelis themselves, here in this demonstration that we're showing, it's from Jerusalem. It looks like the breaking up of the demonstration. The military, it seems, moving in, and security forces moving in some way, shape or form to stop the continuation of that demonstration, which has been, as we understand it, Israelis calling for an end to the war. And most importantly, from their perspective, the return of the 59 hostages still being held by Hamas. Khaled, is that the kind of hope? And I think it's something that might echo what John Linden was saying earlier about people driving some move towards peace. Khaled, is that what you're talking about? Sort of people themselves need to be behind this to change some policy? Yes. Or is that something that Netanyahu just won't listen to?
I mean, I think if that people power can be translated into a potent form of political opposition, then yes. But if it's just people in the streets, well, then I think Netanyahu has learned that he can simply ignore that. Even if his government were to collapse and new elections were to be held, it's unclear after the experiment that we saw before 2022, when Israel kept, you know, the series of elections, there isn't a dominant opposition that the credible opposition that can replace him. And so most likely Netanyahu would remain in power. Either he would win elections or he would remain by default as a caretaker because of inconclusive elections. So that isn't a potent threat at the moment. But it's important, I think, for Israelis to make their voices heard. But I don't see any change that can happen as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is still at the helm.
So many questions, and sadly we're out of time. Khaled, thank you for joining us. Khaled El-Yindi from Georgetown Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Thanks to Nomi Bar-Yakov of the Geneva Center for Security Policy, who joined us from London. Thanks to Mark Lefebvre here in the studio from the Meretz Party and founder of Peace Now.
I can't give
you one last word. We're out of time, Mark. I'm really sorry. But let's hope there is peace now. And thanks to John Linden of the Alliance for Middle East Peace. Mark, I'm really sorry you have to go. Thank you for watching. Stay with us. More to come here on France 24. Mark, I'm done.